The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Who are you going to call? You can call me. I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his Pokemon pal, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 68 of The Big Picture for the week beginning July 17. And coming up on today's show, ready to go Pikachu crazy? Well, join the queue as the world goes wild over Pokemon Go.
And Tarzan swings through the trees to a cinema near you.
And the Ghostbusters are back and something spooky's going on. They're all girls.
Mate, welcome to the show. And by your first one of your first announcements, that you're afraid of girls. I didn't know that about you.
They're very spooky.
Mate, you've just got to try to work them out. Mate, before we get to all those things that we're going to be discussing in the show, Pokemon and Tarzan and Ghostbusters, before we get there, here's some other things that are happening this week. At cinemas, Swiss Army Man opened last Thursday. I talked about this on the show last week. You can find my review at thebigpicturewebsite.com. Basically, one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen, definitely one of the weirdest movies around at the moment. It stars Daniel Radcliffe, you know, Harry Potter, as a corpse, and it stars him as a corpse wandering around in a wilderness and talking about all kinds of philosophical, existential, and rubbishy things. And that's just kind of the tip of the Swiss Army Man iceberg. That is at cinemas now if you want a weird movie.
Well, I'll take your weird and I'll raise you a bucket load of cute. Ben, Ben, do you like puppies?
I do.
Puppies doing hilarious things.
Sure.
Puppies at puppy school.
Who doesn't?
Sleeping, eating, tearing apart household items. What about toddlers? Toddlers in playground pileups. Toddlers versus cats. Toddlers having tantrums or falling asleep in their food. Well, if all this sounds entertaining, you're going to love Make You Laugh Out Loud.
This is a show?
This is a show.
Oh.
Channel 7's latest offering, Tuesday night, 7:30 p.m. This series is straight from the UK with comedians commenting on the best YouTube footage ever posted on puppies and toddlers.
Ah, so it sounds like Funniest Home Videos for the YouTube generation.
Yeah, basically we're ripping off the internet again.
Well,
It previewed on July 5 with the fabulous episode Puppies Make You Laugh Out Loud.
Ha! Huh.
Followed by the next week, Toddlers Make You Laugh Out Loud.
Ha! Huh.
And don't miss next week's doozy, Pensioners Who Make You Laugh Out Loud.
There seems to be a pattern emerging there, Mark.
That's right. We're going to laugh at a vulnerable group every week.
Also opening at cinemas this week is a movie that you might not have heard of because, strangely, it's opened with a bit of a whimper. It's a movie called Demolition. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Naomi Watts. Jake Gyllenhaal is a bloke whose wife dies and he's struggling to deal with the grief of that. But it's from the guy who directed the Oscar-winning Dallas Buyers Club and Wild, that movie that starred Reese Witherspoon a couple of years ago.
So great pedigree.
So all these people are in it, and yet there wasn't even a preview of this movie beforehand. So it's just sort of turned up in cinemas and it's out there at the moment. I'm curious about seeing it, but I'm very, very surprised at how it's just slunk into cinemas so quietly.
They must believe it's so good.
They believe it's something.
It doesn't need any publicity.
Yeah.
Unlike the next biggest film on your agenda this week, Star Trek Beyond, the third in the rebooted franchise that J.J. Abrams kicked off, is opening this week. No. Come back to the radio. Not right now. Sit down, everyone, please. It's opening on Thursday, the 21st, so you have plenty of time to rush out and buy your tickets, as you'll undoubtedly be doing as soon as the show's over. Unless, of course, you're listening to the podcast, in which case you have our permission to press pause now. Back again? Good. Well, Star Trek Beyond stars Simon Pegg, Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, and a bunch of others. Carl Urban. Actually, Idris Elba's in this one as well. Fantastic. He's in everything. And absolutely every reviewer I value the opinion of says it's a dead cert for 9 Academy Awards.
You just made that up.
Well, every reviewer I value the opinion of.
Speaking of things that may or may not be made up, and it's about Star Trek Beyond, Mark, or kind of.
True or false?
We've reached true or false for this week. Before we get to what your kids are watching, true or false, thought I'd link it to Star Trek. So, Leonard Nimoy, who played Spock in the original TV series of Star Trek and the original movies, Leonard Nimoy said, "I made sure never to appear publicly again in my Vulcan outfit," which is like Spock's a Vulcan. So, he made that statement. My true or false statement is, why did he say that? So, did he say that because in 1979, when he went to the first premiere of the original Star Trek movie, he was dressed up like a Vulcan, and he had such issues trying to get out of his suit that he didn't actually go to the toilet. And because he didn't go to the toilet, he had some kind of internal issues because of that. And so as a result, he was so scarred, he never wanted to wear his Vulcan outfit again in the future. Is that true or false, Mark?
curious. I shall put on my ears and think about it.
Think about that while we now think about this. Pokemon! Either you know it, which means you've most likely owned a Game Boy at some point, or you don't, which means you might have bought a Game Boy for your children or something like that. But since 1996, Pokemon has been a flagship computer game for Nintendo's portable gaming platforms. Millions of kids around the world have been enjoying it for the past 20 years, and now, right now, a new generation can start finding its cute little creatures in the real world. In the past fortnight, Pokemon Go, you must have heard about this, Pokemon Go has been released as a gaming app for portable devices in many places. This free game has already brought the internet and the real world to some degree to its knees. So, should such a powerful gaming trend raise concerns for Christian parents? We plugged you in, Mark, to find out. So, tell us all about Pokemon Go.
Well, if that music is starting to sound eerily familiar, it's probably because Pokemon Go has poked its way into your own universe. For those like me who were new to the whole Pokemon phenomena, well, let me give you a basic crash course. The Pokemon storyline, which has been driven by games and cartoons and comics and even movies now, is all about humans interacting with these invisible little sprite-like creatures that inhabit our world. From Pikachu to Mewtwo, they've all got cute little names. There are a range of elemental sprites that can be caught, trained up, and set to be battling each other for the supremacy and glory of their human Pokemon trainers.
Okay. Well,
so the game is now a mobile app, basically a virtual reality game. It uses your GPS plus your camera so that when you actually go looking around the world through your camera, you can now actually spot these Pokemon creatures.
Have there been any other games like this?
There have been a couple, but this is the first major virtual reality game. Like this is, in fact, actually, to be honest, it's a model that's actually been ripped off a spy game, you know, a spy game and a science fiction game.
Right.
So there are other elements out there, but this is really the one that's really capitalized. So Pokemon Go allows players to capture, battle, train virtual Pokemon who appear throughout their real world. It is something that is, they can also get in-game items, they can visit virtual places.
Sure,
they
of course.
Can go,
okay.
They can go to virtual gyms.
So the virtual and the real world collide. How big is this phenomenon? I've heard little bits and pieces about this, haven't really looked into it too much, but what exactly are we talking about here with Pokemon Go?
I think it is very hard to underestimate exactly how big this is. So let me throw some factoids at you.
Go.
Okay. For a start, critics love this game. It's got a 78% rating on Metacritic. It's currently the number one game in all app stores across the planet. In the first week when it was released in the United States, and it was released midweek, so you've only got about 2 or 3 days, it had 7.5 million downloads.
Oh, that's all. Yep.
Yeah, just a few million there.
Whoa.
At the end of the first week, it accounted for more internet traffic than Twitter. Let that sink in.
Than the entirety of Twitter.
Than the entirety of Twitter. By the end of the same week, it had raised Nintendo's share price. Nintendo is the gaming company behind it. By a measly 25%. Adding $10 billion to Nintendo's worth.
Mate,
it is impressive.
Now, given Pokemon has in the past largely been targeted at kids, and this sounds like, and from the sort of stories I'm hearing about Pokemon Go, sounds very addictive. So if I combine those two things together, are we talking here about a gaming drug for kids?
Yes, it's gaming crack. That's basically what we're talking about. Now, look, it is pretty compelling.
That sounds concerning.
Let me get to it. You see, it has accounted for a huge amount of internet traffic in my house alone. I tested it out on 3 boys and myself. And really, what I found is it depends very much on the age of the kid. If you're 6 or 46, as I am, you can be entranced by it. But my 11-year-old was kind of bored after an hour. So it's not really going to suck in every kid. But it is also something that is sucking in heaps of adults. Okay, you see people spotting them, people walking around the streets, and they look like they're looking at their phone, and that's nothing unusual in this day and age. But now they're actually looking through their phone as they're walking across the street, down the road, through parks, because they're capturing creatures and things. I've met people.
It sounds so silly.
I've stopped them and I've just said, "You're playing Pokemon Go, aren't you?" And they've looked at me and we've had that instant camaraderie because I was playing as well. You know,
you don't feel silly as adults or children walking around the streets doing this? You can tell by my voice that I haven't actually done this and I'm unlikely to. But no, you don't?
No, you actually get a certain degree of joy, weirdly, about seeing other people and, you know, meeting other people. So there's a sort of positive there. There are some downsides, okay? Walking around blindly in the streets can be dangerous, okay? Now, let's forget the whole traffic issue. Some of the virtual reality can take you onto private property, can take you to other people's places. So you've got to be cautious about that to begin with. That can, you know, lead to some crisis. There's a fantastic a social faux pas on the internet at the moment, YouTube, where a man is actually playing Pokemon Go while his wife is giving birth in the background. Yeah,
what?
So it is a little compelling. There's also a financial cost to playing. I realized that after we played for a little while with my boys that I was going to have to invest in the in-app purchases to help them collect creatures. So it cost me about $30 in the first day. That's still, I'm still playing out that investment. So it's not like it's going to cost me $30 every day.
It sounds better when you say investment.
Thank you. Mm. And there's also a little bit of concern about virtual bullying. Do you remember our mate Noob Pwner?
I do remember Noob Pwner. When we reviewed Warcraft on the show weeks ago, we had Noob Pwner on talking about his experiences playing Warcraft online. Noob Pwner, we just like saying that.
Yeah, well, Noob Pwner warned us about the idea of online bullying. And weirdly, because virtual reality now takes this game into the actual world around you, so you're playing it on your mobile device, when kids go to gyms, you know, these places where they battle with their own Pokemon creatures, I'm a little concerned about how that's going to play, because massive multiplayer online games, I could keep my kids away from, so to speak, I could decide. But if they're playing this virtual game, bullying can become an issue right in the park next door, you know, and that's the issue that I'm a little concerned
about.
Right,
so it sounds like there's sort of social and even legal issues potentially arising from Pokemon Go. You mentioned before about the joy of bumping into someone in the street who's a Pokemon Go freak like yourself. That sounds quite joyful. Are there other upsides to recommend for parents if their kids are really getting into Pokemon
Go?
Well,
yeah, look, you might be surprised and think to yourself, why are you even talking about this game if you've got so many negatives that you've noted already? And I want to give you a huge positive. For parents like me, the kids want to go outside. Think about that. Like, they actually, look, you know, I've gone to all the expense of buying a backyard in Sydney. I can never get them to use it. Now suddenly they want to go outside. My boys are asking me, when are we going on a Pokemon hunt? Last weekend, I spent 2 hours walking around. The boys were running from place to place, running, movement, fast. They weren't on a couch or anything. You know, I didn't even have to yell at them. They were doing the yelling as they're running between things. So that's fantastic. There's a certain health aspect. To play the game, to hatch eggs is one aspect of the game. You actually have to move. You actually have to walk 5 kilometers to play the game. Can't drive in a car, can't ride a bike. You've actually got to walk to do it. So there's a health aspect that's fantastic. It's also something you can share with your kids very easily. And that's something I'm pretty excited about, because we're talking about things together. It's an easy way of doing things. But here's a spiritual one that was completely unforeseen to me. A mate of mine's a minister, and he tells me that his church and many other churches have been designated by Nintendo or the game creators as Pokestops. So he came out the front of his church and he saw all these teenagers hanging around the front. He went, oh yes, what trouble are they up to? And then he realized that they got backpacks on, their drink bottles and all that sort of stuff. They were going around the neighborhood and they were stopping in at the church because...
They were saving the world from Pokemon.
Exactly. And at the same time, he had an opportunity to interact with them. Smart churches will be thinking about this, okay? If your church has been designated a Pokestop, what are you going to do with that? You're going to have a lot of foot traffic, at least as long as this craze lasts.
Pokemon Go is basically available on any portable device that sports a screen, a camera, and internet access, which is, yep, pretty much any portable device. This is not the sort of game that gets a rating from the Australian government, but we think it's best to call it around about PG, with financial scenes that may scare some parents when they invest heavily in Pokemon Go. Mark, before we talked about Pokemon and Pikachu and all that sort of thing, I posed to you a true or false statement about Star Trek. Leonard Nimoy, the original Dr. Spock, once said, I made sure never to appear publicly again in my Vulcan outfit. Was that because when he went to the first premiere of the original movie back in 1979, he had such trouble going to the toilet and caused himself internal issues that he did not want to dress up as Mr. Spock again in public?
I'm going to go with false, because how hard is it to take ears off if you need to go to the toilet? I don't even understand how that stops you.
Mate, you're exactly right. Leonard Nimoy did say he was never going to dress up again as Spock, but it was because in 1967 at the first Star Trek convention, he was so surprised at the amount of people that showed up. He thought he'd just be handing out like a couple of autographs. There were thousands, and people must have flocked to him so much and so traumatized him, he never dressed up as Mr. Spock again in public.
How could Spock be traumatized? He doesn't experience human emotions. Okay, well, there's huge amounts coming up ahead. We've got The Legend of Tarzan and also, wait for it, the new Ghostbusters.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Very soon, Mark, you're going to be talking to us about The Legend of Tarzan.
Indeed, I will.
Cinemas now. But before you do, we thought we'd take a little bit of a song swing back through Tarzan Lane. Hop. Mark, of course you recognize that as Son of Man, the song that Phil Collins wrote for the 1999 movie Tarzan, the Disney cartoon, which was the first animated version of Tarzan, even though Tarzan's been around since like the early 1900s, first time ever showed up in animated form. When we chose this song to play it on the show, I thought, who remembers that Tarzan movie from the late 90s? No one really talks about that anymore. Boy, was I wrong. I mean, people don't really talk about that much, but at the time, it was the fifth highest grossing film of 1999. It took in almost $500 million around the world.
Yeah, and you're talking pre-2002, so for films, that's massive.
It was incredible. And on Rotten Tomatoes, it's got 90% in its reviews. Like, people loved, apparently, that Tarzan movie from 1999. And also, Phil Collins won an Oscar for another song that turned up on the soundtrack of Tarzan, a film called You'll Be In My Heart. So Tarzan, this movie, I'm kind of glad we picked that song for only the reason of pointing out to myself how horribly wrong I was about that Tarzan movie, thinking that no one saw it, no one cared about it, no one remembered it. Oh, Mark, I was wrong. Last week on our show, we had our resident American, Russ Matthews, and he ran us through about 80 years of Tarzan on the big and the little screen in preparation for the big screen release of The Legend of Tarzan, starring Alexander Skarsgård, Christoph Waltz, Samuel L. Jackson, Australia's own Margot Robbie, and directed by Harry Potter's David Yates. This looks like it might be a blockbuster winner right out of the box, but Mark discovered that along with all the jungle yodeling,
I knew you'd do that.
Yeah. You also get a Tarzan more in tune with today's environmental movement.
You are Tarzan.
You may not like who you were. You may have enemies there. But you need to go home.
Your husband's wildness disturbs me.
I need you to scream for me.
Like a damsel.
He's Tarzan. You're Jane. He'll come for you.
Mark, how do you tell a story that everybody knows? There have been so many Tarzan movies. We haven't had one for a while, sure. But don't we all, even if we have never seen a Tarzan movie or a TV show, we know what the story is, right? So how are you going to make it new for us in The Legend of Tarzan?
This is something that must perplex every scriptwriter when they come across storylines like Batman or Superman or stuff like that. Storylines that are actually really well known, and Tarzan is a really well-known one. So the first thing you do in terms of The Legend of Tarzan is you set it 10 years after Tarzan left the jungle.
Ah, of course you do.
Okay,
yep.
So now we're actually picking up with Skarsgård as Lord of Greystoke,
okay,
in a British manor in England, and being
persuaded. But that sounds kind of boring because he's Tarzan, the King of the Jungle. What do I care about him being King of London?
Well, this is the interesting thing: is he going to embrace that identity or not? Because he's been called back to Africa.
Does he have to wear a shirt in London, or does he just go topless?
Occasionally, he doesn't. But look, you know, I don't want to say too much.
Don't spoil it for me. You're right. Okay.
The fun. And also, one of the interesting things you can do is you build in the flashbacks, but subtly. So, you know, unlike Batman v Superman, which had some really crash and cringeworthy sort of flashbacks to Batman's past, yet in Tarzan, these ones are so subtly woven in and so incomplete too. So you have to imagine kind of what happened. They're like real memory. It's really quite clever. And you don't overplay the gimmicks. So you don't do the Tarzan cry every 5 minutes. In fact,
even if you're in the cinema and you're watching it,
no, not at all. You see,
I fear for the people when I get to The Legend of Tarzan and what I'm going to do in the back row.
You should watch it at home. Help me now. Okay, but it's often muted and kind of like, and it's actually contextual too. It sounds like he's screaming something like a word,
just like I did.
Yeah, something like that anyway. Mm. Okay, and Tarzan, you know, turns out basically to be a story that's more about Jane's backstory and the bad blood between Tarzan, some enemies in the jungle.
And Jane, his
how
wife,
they came together.
Jane,
yeah.
His wife is played by Margot Robbie.
Yeah. So you've got this sort of great fun for older members of the family who might know the story, but they're sort of digging into the details. But there's plenty there also for people who have never heard it before.
So as much as you're saying a lot of this is set in London and him as, what is he, Earl of Greystoke? But
Lord.
Lord of Greystoke. But is he still king of the jungle? Like, do we still get jungly stuff in this? Like, looking at the, there's a poster in our studio at the moment behind you of Tarzan in the jungle with like gorillas leaping around him. Is he still king of the jungle?
Look, 90% of the film is still in the jungle. Okay. So I don't want to disappoint people. But it's and he's still, yes, he's still, Tarzan's still the strongest, the bravest, the most faithful man out there. But this is a really interesting reimagination of Tarzan.
So you think it does answer the question that is burning in me, which is why do we need, or did the world really need the legend of Tarzan? Do we need Tarzan coming back?
This is different. There's definitely different, a major point of difference. He's not stronger than anything. You know, the whole idea of Tarzan sort of wrestling lions and beating up on animals, you know, that sort of stuff. No. This Tarzan, okay, for a start, it's a little more realistic. No man goes head with a gorilla and wins, okay? Just sheer body mass, that's not going to happen. Okay, but...
Sounds like you've tried it.
What do you do on your weekends when you're not playing Pokemon Go? But firstly, Tarzan gets beaten up in this, okay? And in fact, the way he wins often is by fitting in and by understanding what the animals require and that sort of stuff, not getting down on top of them and you know, rubbing their face in the dirt. What makes Tarzan the great spirit is the fact that he has the spirit of the jungle in him, and so he can live in harmony with creatures.
So this is a little bit like the Jungle Book?
It is kind of a lot like the Jungle Book. It's a lot more like an idea of environmentalism, which we're much more comfortable with. The idea that we're not enforcing ourselves over the environment, but we're actually living in harmony with it.
Right. And so this sounds close to the Bible's idea of humans living within God's creation, or across the sweep of the movie, The Legend of Tarzan, do you actually move further away from that idea? Like, does it hold to that or not?
This is the yes and no film for Christians, okay? When it comes to environmentalism, there's a lot that Christians can get itchy about because, like Tarzan does, the Legend of Tarzan does raise environmentalism to the level of sort of like a religion again. So you actually have the idea of Tarzan being equal with all the animals, which is something that as Christians we don't really sort of get in favor of. God actually made humanity. It's a bit un-PC, but God made humanity as the peak of his creation and placed creation underneath humanity. But yet at the same time, there is a real sense of how we should be relating to the things around us, not as things to be used at our disposal, but also to be shepherded and taken care of. And that's
to look after, not to exploit.
And that's definitely God's idea of being stewards of creation.
To use, not abuse.
It does depend. Look, to be honest, I don't think there was any real intent on showing us, you know, as the shepherds of creation, but rather as standing alongside an ape or standing alongside a lion or that sort of stuff. And to me, that always makes me a little worried because I have to explain to my kids afterwards, this is how God made the world, and yet we have a responsibility. And that's why we're responsible before God, because we have been placed above the creatures.
The Legend of Tarzan stars Alexander Skarsgård, Christoph Waltz, Samuel L. Jackson, and Australia's Margot Robbie. It's rated M for mature scenes and violence. You can swing into a cinema right now with your little monkeys, and they can all go along to see it. Mark, we're alive and well on Facebook. For people who don't know and are regular listeners to the show, we create videos of the reviews that we do each week. We put them up online because we'd like people to share them each week. If you've missed the show or you heard the show and you want to recommend something to a friend, a really good way to do that is find us at The Big Picture Show on Facebook and find the video reviews that we post and share them around. We hope they're very helpful in terms of people when they're weighing up a Christian perspective on movies and TV shows to watch, that they can check out the videos, make up their minds after that, and hopefully we can help you find a good direction at cinemas and TV. So check us out on Facebook.
And of course, if you're not actually a Facebook person, let's face it, not all of us are, you'll also find us at thebigpicturewebsite.com, where pretty much everything we've got is laid out there. Also, the podcast. You might not know, but the radio version, which is a great show in itself, is the tip of the iceberg. And the podcast version has so much more rich material for you to enjoy each week. Well, coming up, and speaking of things to enjoy yet, we've still got the Ghostbusters coming, and also Ben's top five non-scary films for people who get scared too easily in cinema. Welcome back. The Legend of Tarzan is out now. Star Trek Beyond is out next Thursday. Ben is about to review another major new release, Ghostbusters, the all-new female version of the 1980s comedy classic. Everything old seems new again in Hollywood. So this week, for our press record segment, Ben met with Empire Magazine's senior editor, Dave Brown, for his take on this trend of sequels, remakes, reboots, rehashes, and reimaginings. Ben began by asking Dave, what exactly is the new Ghostbusters movie?
Seems like it is a remake. It's basically the same film, the same plot, the same motivations, but with women in the same roles. I mean, reboot, you kind of assume it's going to be something a little bit different. Different characters in the same situation.
Yes, yes.
Whereas this seems like it is exactly the same.
Now, it feels to me, and I think a lot of people share this sentiment, that even this year alone, let alone the last couple of years, feels like on the increase, we keep talking about reboots, remakes, rehashes, that kind of thing.
There are a lot of films coming out this year which are sequels. It's almost like it is the year of the sequel that no one asked for. Just briefly looking, we've already had like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Independence Day 2, Now You See Me 2, Alice Through the Looking Glass, all big sequels. Hollywood spent a lot of money on them, but no one went to see them because I don't think anyone wanted them.
No one was really hanging out for those, were they?
No. And now we've got Bad Santa, we've got Jack Reacher, we've got Bridget Jones's Baby, we've got the third of the Da Vinci Code films, The Mechanic Resurrection. Whoa. You know, who knows what that's going to be? New Jason Bourne, Star Trek. It is a non-stop cavalcade. That's the tip of the iceberg of how many sequels.
And that's just this year that's been or still to come. Now, this, I think, then leads on to what seems like an obvious statement, which is Hollywood. Let's just blame Hollywood, not the rest of the world and where they make movies. Let's just focus on Hollywood. Hollywood has no new ideas. They've got nothing to offer us that's fresh and original. When we talk about that, I think a lot of audience members scream that out most weeks when they look at their cinema guide. People will sort of start alleging, though, that this is a new phenomenon. Do you think that's true?
Look, I don't think it is. If you look back through the annals of Hollywood history, from the Universal Monsters and Abbott and Costello, they've constantly made loads and loads of movies. And some of them pretty good, like The Bride of Frankenstein is an excellent sequel. And I think it all stems from the fact that if a film makes money, Hollywood is going to want more of that money.
So what you're saying, Dave, is reboots, rehashes, remakes, sequels, all that kind of thing has been happening pretty much since Hollywood began. So things like Keystone Cops, yes, back in the 20s and 30s.
So it's completely not a new thing. And then through the 70s, the Jaws films, like I think there were four of those, and Star Wars. You know, everyone loves Star Wars and everyone's still whinging about sequels. If Hollywood didn't make sequels, there wouldn't have been an Empire Strikes Back. So I think it's not necessarily a bad thing that they make sequels. You just kind of like to think that occasionally they make good ones.
And come to think of it, Dave, aren't we a bit of the problem? As in, if we didn't show up and see these movies since Hollywood has began, well, they wouldn't keep doing this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when Ghostbusters comes out, everyone's going to whinge and complain. And go, oh, I can't believe there's a sequel or a remake or a reboot. And then it will earn $100 million and they're going to make another one. And it's only the fault of the people who allow Hollywood to make the money are the cause of the remakes, reboots, rehashes.
We're the problem. Thanks, Dave.
My pleasure.
Who is Hollywood going to call? Well, when it wants a new comedy vehicle for a quartet of funny ladies, Ghostbusters. Yep, the Ghostbusters. One of the 1980s most successful and revered comedies, Ghostbusters is back in the shape of a mighty female foursome. While it raises obvious questions like, why did you do this? The new Ghostbusters also conjures up the specter of not being serious about the natural and the supernatural.
We have dedicated our whole lives to studying the paranormal. Now there's sightings all over the city.
There are people out there that need our help.
Holtzman, you're a brilliant engineer.
Aaron, no one's better at quantum physics than you.
We can provide a real service.
I'm joining the club.
You guys are really smart about this science stuff, but I know New York. And I can borrow a car from my uncle.
You didn't disclose that the vehicle was going to be a hearse.
It's a Cadillac!
So, Mark, for anyone who didn't see or can't remember the original Ghostbusters, this new Ghostbusters is basically a very, very similar version of the storyline. But as you just mentioned, it now stars all females in the lead roles, not Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray, etc., that were in the original film. So Kristen Wiig, a female comedian, plays Erin, and Melissa McCarthy, another female comedian, plays Abby. Their friends have kind of gone their separate ways. Both of them are scientists who kind of deal with the paranormal, the supernatural, and that sort of thing. And then they come back together in New York City with a couple of other women and become, as the title would suggest, Ghostbusters. They go around trying to rid the city of an increasing number of supernatural sightings that are happening. All these different spooks are kind of coming out of the woodwork across New York. And so they set up their own business, effectively, like in the original Ghostbusters,
trying to rid the city
of the ghosts.
I'm starting to feel like this is all eerily familiar.
Yeah, that's right. If you love the original film, you might be surprised, possibly in a good way, of how closely it sticks to the first film.
How positive of you. Should they have done it? I mean, a remake that's literally a remake.
I don't think so, based on what's up on screen. Not because you shouldn't ever touch it. I think occasionally you can get remakes of movies that come out that you think... that an audience will think, oh, well, like that was either on par or better than, or at least like it makes its own case for existing. I don't think this one really does. On the positive front, as I was just trying to do a few moments ago, the best thing, or some of the best things to be said for this new version of Ghostbusters, is it's very reverent and respectful of the original, so much so that it almost doesn't try to take any risks whatsoever or do much different, apart from putting women in the lead roles. It almost doesn't want to destroy the memory of the original Ghostbusters, so we'll make a new one and effectively try to make it a bit of a carbon copy. As they're trying to do that, though, and as you heard as I'm trying to explain the storyline, by not diverging too far and being super cautious about what it is they put on screen, including the fact that it's rated PG. So one of the good things about this movie is they didn't just turn it into a modern adult comedy full of sex and swearing and that kind of thing. As they're doing all of that, though, there is a remarkable lack of fun and joy and spark I found about this Ghostbusters. That's my major criticism of it. The women in it, Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, some other actresses called Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones, who are lesser known to wider audiences. The four of them go together fine, but if you remember the original Ghostbusters, Mark, which I'm sure you do and plenty of other people do, the rapport, particularly between Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd, let alone the other guys in it like Harold Ramis, that had some zing to it and some spark. And then when the ghosts come in, it all like meshed together nicely. On this occasion with this new Ghostbusters, I just found it was surprisingly, I'm just kind of shrugging my shoulders as it goes along about, well, this is okay, but I'm not really getting into it.
Okay, well, what about the Christian side of it? I mean, is there any danger to actually taking something which we literally build our life around, the spiritual, and turning into something of a comedy?
Sure, there's always dangers of it. And then go back to the bit about this is a comedy, so maybe we shouldn't be trying to take it too seriously anyway. So the fact that Ghostbusters uses ghosts and the supernatural and spooks to kind of make jokes about, I'm not sure if we necessarily should be having a go at that. We should be more looking at ourselves. And underneath your question is a really good question for us about how seriously do we take the supernatural realm. Now, up on Ghostbusters, it is treated a bit like a joke, even particularly the nastier elements of it. The storyline going through here about why these ghosts are coming through is they're all these disgruntled, angry souls who are coming back to pretty much attack New York City because these souls were bullied and mistreated in this life, and they basically want to lay waste to New York City and the rest of the world because they want to kind of get rid of it. And to some degree, what we understand from the Bible, the spiritual realm, and particularly led by the devil and the evil forces that can go on in this world, to some degree, the devil's looking to do that, in as much as turn us away from God, make this world a terrible, atrocious place, even worse than you can imagine it to be now. That's his kind of mission statement. So if we don't take that seriously and just sort of joke along and, you know, think of lines like from The Usual Suspects, that great line about the best trick the devil ever pulled was to make us think that he doesn't actually exist. Jesus himself called the devil the father of liars. If you bring all that together and just think through that the best thing the devil could do was make us joke about the spiritual realm, not take it seriously, particularly when it comes to the evil negative forces that can come from it. Yes, there is huge danger in that. But Ghostbusters isn't attempting to do anything much more than entertain us with the supernatural realm, as opposed to, you know, really, really, really not take it seriously.
Okay, well, we've still got a bunch of scientists who are trying to find truth about existence through science.
Yeah, that's going through Ghostbusters,
Do they find it?
Yeah, they do, but it's this remarkably convenient truth. So Ghostbusters, at various points, the scientists that Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy play, they really go on about their wanting to prove the existence of ghosts, that they know this to be true. And then, of course, a lot of their experiments and their contraptions and the ecto guns and cars and all the sort of contraptions they've got go towards actually demonstrating there are ghosts. Hooray! So that's a very convenient truth that they've been able to describe here. A fascinating thing I found about Ghostbusters, I reckon the most strongest things that came out of Ghostbusters were two things. One, Chris Hemsworth, who's got a cameo in this as a male bimbo secretary, is fantastic. He's got the best comic timing out of the entire film. He's worth seeing it alone just for his cameo. He's fantastic. Forget about all the cameos of the original Ghostbusters stars. They show up in this, but they're poor. That's one thing I liked about it. The second is there's this really interesting subplot in Ghostbusters about inconvenient truth. Andy Garcia, the actor, plays the mayor of New York, and he basically wants to shut the Ghostbusters down because they're telling people what's actually going on. And he says, and his people around him say, don't tell people what's going on. Lie to them about what's going on because we can't handle the truth. He doesn't say we can't handle the truth. He doesn't actually say that. But that's what he's getting at, that people cannot handle the truth of a situation. So don't freak them out with it. Just let them go on their merry way. And to me, that struck a massive chord with me. And as a Christian, there are plenty of things about Christianity and the truths of this world that people can find super confronting, including myself. And you can just want to hide from what seems like an inconvenient truth. But even as Ghostbusters demonstrates, you cannot hide from the truth. Particularly if it's true, it's going to happen. And so it's worth investigating as opposed to shutting your eyes to. As opposed to Ghostbusters, I think it might be more of shutting your eyes to, not necessarily investigating.
Okay, well, who are you going to call? If the answer for you is still Ghostbusters, then it's now showing at a cinema near you. It stars Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, Chris Hemsworth, and a stack of cameos. It's rated PG for mild supernatural themes, or whatever that means, and coarse language, and some scenes that may scare young children. Well, actually, if you want to read a bit more about Ghostbusters and other things like that, in the next edition of Eternity, sorry, the current edition of Eternity, Ben has an article called Same Old, Same Old, which reflects on Hollywood's determination to remake everything it has already made before and our happiness to part with our money when they do. What does that actually say about us? Also, you'll find that in Eternity, Pokemon Go is sending gamers to the most unexpected places, as we mentioned earlier in the show, and there's a whole article, I think it's fascinating, about churches who are interacting with Pokemon Go. So really, you should have a look at this. If you go search off the Bible Society's website, which is where all the Eternity articles are, biblesociety.org.au, but you can also test out their brand new website, which is coming soon. So Eternity has this fantastic website that I'd thoroughly like to recommend. There's a little link, it's a bit hidden at the moment, there's a little link at the top of all the articles, and you can see what the article might look like in its alternate reality.
Ooh, exciting times on the interwebs. Also on the interwebs, insights.uca.org.au. As we mentioned earlier in the show, our resident American, Russ Matthews, regularly joins us here on The Big Picture. He also regularly reviews on Insight's website. Check out his reviews of all the latest releases, including Ghostbusters and The Legend of Tarzan. Because, Mark, we don't mind if people seek out other people's opinion. We just ask that you listen to us first.
And still to come, the top five scary, non-scary films. Welcome back. Now, we've been talking about Ghostbusters. Basically, is it a scary film? Isn't it a scary film? Often depends on the people in your household, wouldn't you say, Ben?
I'd say so. And given it's rated PG, Mark, there might be a lot of parents and caregivers out there that are thinking of taking the whole family along. I don't think it's as scary as the original film, but still, your kids might be a little bit freaked out by what they see on screen. Now, talking about that, and I've also heard about some younger children being a bit scared of the BFG, even though you might think, well, the older kids wouldn't be. We were talking about, like, a lot of people would avoid horror movies, particularly for kids, let alone for adults.
Yeah, there's a smart one. You're not going to take them into Halloween.
You know you are definitely going to be scared in those. But what about those movies that are non-scary movies, movies that are definitely not set up to scare us, but they have scary scenes in them? And we thought, well, why not concoct a top five list out of that?
Five.
So this is your non-scary, non-scary film list.
Yeah, or non-scary, scary list, if you will, Mark.
And at number five?
The Matrix from 1999, because I think a lot of people, when they came out of that movie, science fiction film, starring Keanu Reeves, there's a guy who discovers that reality, a little bit like Pokemon Go, isn't like what you expected it to be. And unlike Pokemon Go, though, it actually starts to blow your mind with just how reality isn't what you think it is and what's going on behind it and the machines that are running it and how humans are cogs in the machine, etc., etc. I think The Matrix terrified a lot of people. I'm not saying it's real. I'm just saying a lot of people were freaked out and didn't expect that they would be when they saw The Matrix.
What I think would have been far more terrifying is if Neo had woken up in that little sort of stasis tube of his and found Pikachu staring at him.
9:39's The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, that was terrifying.
That was terrifying. I think a lot of people, adults included, forget how terrifying The Wizard of Oz is. You don't talk about The Wizard of Oz in terms of it being a scary piece of work, but you just list off some of the things that happen in 1939's The Wizard of Oz, like, let alone being caught up in a tornado that gets you into another land. A house that lands on a witch and kills that witch, and then other witches show up threatening they're going to kill you, and then Dorothy and Toto are attacked by flying monkeys.
And let's not forget the fact that the witch sets the scarecrow on fire.
And there's a giant-headed wizard, and they're singing Munchkins. My goodness, Mark.
And your little dog, too.
And your little dog, too. The eye melting scene, all of that kind of thing. There is a lot of really quite disturbing material in The Wizard of Oz.
I remember as a kid, probably even up to about 12, I mean, this is a bit embarrassing, but still not being able to watch him over the first hour of it. I would go to bed early. I've got to go to bed.
And I think there's even a scary message at the end of it for kids, which I think one of the messages you can take from The Wizard of Oz is don't run away from home. It seems like a big publicity campaign for don't run away from home, because if you do, you might go to battle with death-defying witches, you might have to fight flying monkeys, and possibly be unable to ever return home. And that's how scary that non-scary movie is.
You'd be satisfied with Kansas. That's it.
1984's The Neverending Story.
Okay, tell me why that was scary.
Because, again, like all the films selected on this list, when people recall that film or talk about that film, they don't usually talk about it in terms of scariness. You tend to think more about how cool that 1980s song was that was on the soundtrack.
By Lamal. The scariest thing in that film has to be that man's hair. Do you remember how crazy Lamal's hair was?
That's the kind of memories people have of The Neverending Story, or how cool the Luck Dragon was and how you really wanted one yourself. And this amazing adventure of this boy reading a book and going into his imagination, or is it? Or is this the real world or fantasy? Who knows? And he's effectively trying to help save this world, all very heroic and that kind of thing. But The Neverending Story, what it was driven by was a world that's being threatened to be destroyed by the nothing. The nothing. There's a massive cloud of nothing rolling through this imaginative universe, threatening to just destroy it and do what it says in the title, the nothing. The nothing. Now, let alone the nothing rolling in all the way through Neverending Story, threatening the boy warrior Atreyu and the Luck Dragon and how they're going to save the day. Let alone that. But when I remember being in the cinema as a kid watching The Neverending Story, and there's a moment towards the end of the movie that's still etched in my mind. Now, for the record, I wasn't scared by this scene,
Mark.
Oh,
no, not Ben.
When I was an 8-year-old lad, I wasn't scared by this scene. Not one bit. But the kid behind me lost their mind and their popcorn when there's a scene where there's this wolf creature called Gamork, who's like the lapdog of the nothing, and he's sent out to like track down Atreyu. There's a scene where he's in a cave, and you can't see Gamork. You can just hear Gamork. But then he jumps out. Of course he's going to jump out. That always happens. But he jumps out, and the kid behind me, I still remember that kid screaming in my ear and then sort of whimpering for the rest of the movie.
It's amazing what psychological treatment can allow you to do to distance something. I believe this boy behind you was called Den or something. 2.
Now for something completely different. Mark.
Ah, Monty Python scares me too.
Oh, mate, thank you for picking me up on a Monty Python reference. But I'm not talking about Monty Python. No, I'm talking about 2007's No Country for Old Men. The Coen Brothers movie, I think it picked up a couple of Oscars in that year. I think it did. It stars Tommy Lee Jones and Josh Brolin and Javier Bardem. It's basically like a Western meets a sort of film noir tale about stolen money and people coming to track you down for that stolen money.
Yeah, it's kind of more like a detective thriller than anything.
It is, and usually remembered like that until you get to the bit where you remember the character that Javier Bardem played in that film, Chigurh, who basically seems like the embodiment of straight-up evil on screen. And there is a scene in this, there are a number of scenes involving Chigurh that will just haunt your dreams for the rest of your life, or your nightmares, as the case may be. But there's one scene where he goes into a roadhouse in the middle of nowhere.
The service station, yeah.
The service station, right? And he begins with small talk with his owner, who's just this normal, everyday bloke. And the guy makes small talk. And from that moment on, Anton Chigurh, who by this stage, at this stage of the movie, the audience already knows this guy's a killer and will kill seemingly at whim. So we know that, but the guy behind the counter doesn't know that. Mm. And the rest of the conversation is so tense because the guy behind the counter, who's just going about his everyday business and trying to respond to this very creepy, menacing, ominous conversation, every response that Chigurh gives is this like unbelievably menacing response, and you don't know where it's going to go as a viewer, let alone this guy behind the counter. And it boils down to a coin toss, and what the coin toss is about, the guy behind the counter doesn't know, but we know. And Anton Chigurh, all he really says is, you stand to win everything if you win this coin toss. And what he's alluding to is this man's life. But the guy doesn't really know that, or he kind of suspects that. It's incredibly chilling. And I think when you talk about No Country, even when people remember Avi Yardim, not necessarily quaking in their boots until they think about what he does on screen. But that isn't as scary as number one.
One.
Mark, this one, I really wanted to put it in because I like the movie, but I realize it's on a bit of a knife edge because it's Monsters, Inc. from 2001. Now, Monsters, Inc. was terrifying. Now, the name alone would suggest it's terrifying, and there are elements of the storyline that are deliberately terrifying because monsters in the film are trying to scare kids because they power their city from kids' screams, so they need those screams to power their city, and so they need to freak those kids out. But that's all happening on screen, so you might be scared by that, particularly if you're a younger viewer. So there are elements of Monsters, Inc. that are deliberately scary. But I think when people talk about Monsters, Inc., they don't really talk about it being a terrifying adventure. They talk more about Sully and Mike, the main characters, and Boo, the little girl, and you know what they get up to. But one of the reasons I chose it is because the film ultimately comes to show, I think, that it's not that scary to start living in the opposite way to the way that you'd already lived. So a lot of people can be scared by that. And I think Monsters, Inc. kind of raises this idea that we can be so fearful of some other situation that we don't even investigate it. I reckon Christianity's like that. So you get Monsters, Inc. and these monsters don't really want to live another way. They're frightened of doing that and they keep doing what they've always done. But in the end, and I think as you can discover with Christianity, if you've been scared of it, if you investigate it more, you'll start seeing that the way God wants you to live actually is leading to a much better life. And that's what Monsters, Inc. happens. Without trying to ruin the end of the movie, monsters do come to learn that there's a different way of living things and they shouldn't be scared by it. So the reason I picked it at number one on the scary scenes from non-scary movies list is mainly for the lesson that we learn at the end of Monsters, Inc.
Morning, Sully.
Morning, Sully.
How you doing, big guy?
Hey. Go get him, Mr. Sullivan. Quiet. You're making him lose his focus. Oh, no. Sorry.
Scary feet, scary feet, scary feet. Oh, the kids away. Twins and a bunk bed.
A human kid!
Come on!
That thing is a killing machine!
Well, that's
Monsters, Inc. Love it.
Well, that's all we've got for this week. But coming up next week, why parents need to know that Batman, the Killing Joke, is not what they think it is.
There's also going to be a Jane Austen reimagining, Mark, a reboot, a rehash. Love and Friendship cordially invites your attention.
And Ewan McGregor and Homeland's Damian Lewis in Holiday Spy Mission, Our Kind of Traitor.
All of that coming up next week, Mark, where I still will be Ben McKechnie.
And I'll be Mark Hadley. See you then.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.